Your eyes and your vision are under attack, damaging blue light from the sun, your phone, your computer, your tablet, even light bulbs and car headlights is constantly bombarding you. The good news is our eyes actually already have a line of defense to counter the effects of blue light. This defense is made up of three pigments called carotenoids. MacuHealth with MicroMicell, the only supplement with the exclusive patent on all three macular carotenoids and MicroMicell technology.
Do your patients know what presbyopia is?
There are people who are afraid of the press.
Have you talked to your patients about multifocal contact lenses?
I've heard the bifocal, but not
right,
multifocal.
Do you need help with your multifocal strategy? Learn more at the conclusion of this episode. With more screen usage and indoor time, myopia, also known as nearsightedness, is increasing and getting worse in children. Now, certified eye doctors can prescribe MySight One Day, the first and only FDA-approved soft contact lens to slow myopia progression in age-appropriate children. Visit CooperVision.com to find a Brilliant Futures certified eye doctor near you. Good morning, I'm Dr. Kerry Gelbin. Welcome to Open Your Eyes Radio. Please listen as I discuss the newest information in the world of health, nutrition, and sports every Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Central Time on AM 1280 The Patriot. Also, please share your thoughts by emailing me at drkerrygelb@gmail.com. That's drkerrygelb@gmail.com. And visit my website, drkerrygelb.com. For those who love the game of baseball, baseball becomes part of our soul, an obsession run by statistics shared by fathers and sons, fathers and daughters, and now moms and sons and daughters. Today's guest, Ken Cavazzoni, the author of Immortal, a tale of a baseball hero that mixes baseball stardom, altruism, love, patriotism, and hope. Ken Cavazzoni is a baseball lifer. Upon graduating from Columbia University, he was selected by the Cincinnati Reds in the 15th round of the 1991 Major League Baseball Amateur Draft. After a brief stint as a professional player, he continued his involvement in the game as a coach and evaluator. His book, Immortal, is available at major book retailers. His website is at kencavazzoni.com. That's Ken, CavAzzoni.com. Ken, thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
You know, Ken, I'm a lover of baseball like yourself. What is it about baseball, the game, that gets under our skin, that we love it so much?
Who was it? I think it was Jim Boughton who said that not that it gets under our skin, but we become part of the game. You know, it's a game that's played between fathers and sons, just having a catch in the backyard. I think that's where it originates. It's a game that's different than any of the other games. All the other games, there's some aspect of putting a ball in a goal, and baseball is not like that. There's so many unique aspects to the rules of the game. And it's also been a game that has become a part of our country's fabric. You know, so the origins are so deep that I think that's what really gets to me. That's what gets to me, at least.
You know, you played professional baseball. How high a level did you play?
I only made it up to single A. So I had a brief career. I graduated from Columbia University, got drafted in a decent round. Played a year, had a very good initial year, got hurt. Had some hamstring injuries, played the following year, and things didn't work out for me. In the end, I look back at that, and I don't think I was quite as athletic as I needed to be. That kind of hit me after playing at that level for a couple of years. I was a good player. I was a good hitter. I'd give you a professional at bat, but without question, there was an athleticism thing that I wish I had a little bit more of.
What do you think the difference is between a double-A, triple-A player and a major league player? Is it mostly mental? And how much of it is mental? How much of it would you say is actual physical?
When I was my first year in spring training, Bill White was the National League Baseball Commissioner. And he did a little thing in our locker room before a game or before practice. And he started asking players, can you throw the ball 90 miles an hour? He was asking a pitcher. Yeah, I can. How about you? Can you hit the ball 400 feet? Have you ever hit a ball 400 feet? Absolutely. So he asked that same question. He said, what makes you different than the major leaguers? Because you can accomplish the same things they can. And it really comes down to consistency as being repeatable in your biomechanics. Major leaguers just do it on a more consistent basis than a minor leaguer. The talent level could be almost equal, but can you repeat what you do? That's really the difference between the levels. Single A, you got a lot of raw players. You got a big mix of ages. You know, you have high school players, level players playing with college level players. Double A gets certainly more refined. And Triple A, there's a broad range too, sometimes with older players on the end of their careers and also prospects.
You know, growing up, who were your role models as players? Who did you look up to that you thought, you know, I just love this player. I love watching him.
Oh, that's easy. That right off the bat, Don Mattingly. I was a Don Mattingly guy. I look back at my swing and I kind of laugh. You know, I was a little bit bigger, I think, than Don Mattingly, but I was crouched like him, but from the right side. He was the guy I looked towards all the time.
And Don Mattingly, how many games in a row did he hit a home run? It was like 10 games or something?
I think it was eight. That was a crazy year. It was either eight or nine. Yeah, I remember that. Thing about him is he was an athlete too. I mean, he could play baseball. He could play basketball. He played third base for the Yankees. People don't even remember that. He played a couple. I don't think he played a full game at third, but he spotted at third as a lefty third baseman. He played outfield to start his career. He was just a great player.
You know, baseball has changed so much. When I was younger, baseball players didn't lift weights. They weren't massively strong, but there were still guys that hit many home runs, like Willie Mays and Mickey Mantle. I mean, there was a lot of Harmon Killebrews. But now the players are in the weight room. What has changed to put the players in the weight room? Is it all about hitting home runs and making money compared to the thin players when the game was so different?
Wow. I got to veer into a really quick story about that because it's relevant to my book too. When I was a player at Columbia University, Bart Giamatti was the Major League Baseball commissioner. And Bart Giamatti considered himself, he liked to roam the halls of academia, as they say. He was a Yale guy, very intelligent man. And he actually came to our university one day and had breakfast. I think it was called Bagels with Bart. Our baseball team had breakfast with Bart Giamatti, and it was great. He sat there and just had an open forum with us, and he was asking questions like, you know, just ask me anything. And people were asking him about, how come you suspended this guy for five games, but Pedro Guerrero threw a bat, and you only suspended him for three? And it was a very light conversation. And he kept saying, you guys could ask me anything. So there I went, and I decided to ask him a question. And after I asked him the question, the room got dark and he got angry with me, and it was unbelievable. And I remember it like it was yesterday. I asked him, with the emergence of players like Jose Canseco, is baseball going to do anything about steroids and steroid testing? And you got to remember, this was 1989, and he actually passed away several months after, just a few months after. And he got angry with me, and he turned the entire conversation into something that it shouldn't have been. How dare I ask that such a question? And back then, I was a prospect. I never did steroids, but it certainly crossed my mind. And it was a topic that, as college players, we talked about. And here was the baseball commissioner looking at me. And basically, it was the first time that any adult of any authority lied right to my face. So there was a desire to have home runs hit. And I think that from that steroid era, it carried on through. That's where the game is right now.
Well, you talk a little bit about that in the book, about you, the hero of your book, T.C. Hunter. And he really is a hero in your book, not to give too much away. But who was T.C. Hunter? Is he a combination of Ted Williams and Ty Cobb? Who was he to you?
Well, I was always a Ted Williams fan because of a lot of different angles, not just his hitting. I thought he was the best hitter that ever played the game, but also the fact that he served in World War II and in Korea as a pilot. Ty Cobb. So TC's named after Williams Cobb, and he just happens to have the surname of Catfish Hunter, which kind of adds to his, the whole picture there. TC has the hitting ability of Ted Williams. He's got the grit of Ty Cobb and also the competitiveness of Catfish Hunter is what I wanted to do. And that's how I want to make my hero. It was a character that I thought about for a long time.
And where did you come up with the names of the different baseball players? It was kind of like real baseball player names.
Some of them are real. Some of them are players that I played with. Maybe I used the first name of one person and the last name of another. When I write, that's one of the most difficult things is trying to figure out, I need a character here. What's the name?
In the book, there's a hero, TC Hunter. And we were talking about where he got the name. It was a combination of Ted Williams, Ty Cobb. And I want to ask you about Ty Cobb a little bit. And you talk a little bit about this in your book. People always thought Ty Cobb was a racist. He came from a tough place. Tell us a little bit about the great Ty Cobb.
Yeah, he did come from a tough place. And there was certainly a racist element to some of the things that happened. But I can tell you that Ty Cobb was kind of an equal opportunity hater. he was an angry guy. As it is told, Ty Cobb's father was shot by his mother. There's a little bit of a gray area there, but I think Mr. Cobb thought his wife was having an affair, went away on a business trip, but really didn't go away, came back at night, and the wife shot him, killed him. So that a few months later, Ty Cobb was playing baseball and had that burden on him. Very strange situation, but I think it added to his anger and his persona for sure. And he was just an aggressive player. He was just a guy that wouldn't take anything. There was a racist element to certain things, but at the same time, it was told that he was one of the people that was involved in integrating the game and wanted to integrate the game. So I don't really buy the complete racist narrative on him. I think he was more complex than that. And I also think he was just a product of the time too.
You know, baseball has changed. Back in the old days, baseball players were really God-fearing men, very patriotic, very proud Americans. Talk about that era of baseball and mixing baseball, maybe a little bit with politics, where the baseball players were really proud Americans.
That's one of the back premises to my novel. Now, it's a fiction novel, but I wanted to integrate a lot of that in it. As mentioned, the baseball is run kind of parallel with our country's history. If you think back to how the game started, now, who do you think? Everybody thinks Abner Doubleday, right? Created baseball somehow, right? History says no. It was a game that evolved over time, and there was a guy by the name of Alexander Cartwright, I think, who really developed the rules to the game. But think about Abner Doubleday that people don't know. History tells us that he might have actually started the Civil War. He took the first shot at Fort Sumter. Most people don't have any idea about that. So it's a really interesting thing. And baseball was played during the Civil War by both the North and the South as a way to keep the troops in shape and to pass time. So the game's kind of evolved along history. There's been a patriotic element through it all. You know, in the 1900s, you had baseball became something that grew into the fabric of society. It was the first real sport that had giant stadiums and media coverage. And, you know, then came Cobb and Ruth, and the game really took off from there. Then you look into the 1930s with the Great Depression and how they tried to, and matter of fact, the Great Depression was really the first time that the powers that be tried to influence the game by taking the game out of the dead ball era and moving into something where people were hitting more home runs. But I think there's a really significant time period in history with baseball is 1941. So 1941, what you had going on is you had Hitler overseas gaining power. You had the war drums beating here, and everybody was very torn up about what was going to happen next. But baseball kind of gave a little bit of a relief to that. And there was two things that went on in that baseball season. You had Joe DiMaggio's hitting streak. And remember, back then, they didn't have anything besides like we have where we communicate readily. So it was a matter of, you know, the next morning, hey, did he get one last night? You know, and it became a thing that distracted the populace. And then at the end of that season, Ted Williams was hitting 399.6 or whatever he was hitting going into the last day of the season. He had a doubleheader. His manager encouraged him to sit out that doubleheader so he can maintain his 400 average because it would round up. And Ted Williams said, absolutely no, I'm not going to do that. And he ended up going 6-for-8 in the season and in the doubleheader and finished the season at 406. So in 1941, baseball served as a distraction from everything that was going on. And after that season, a few months later, we had Pearl Harbor and thrown into World War II. I think there was like 500 Major League Baseball players that enlisted to fight in World War II. Yogi Berra was at D-Day. He was at Normandy Beach. I mean, it was different. Like you said, Ted Williams was a pilot. You know, he fought combat missions in Korea. There was a different element to it all. And I do approach that subject a little bit, comparing it to modern day where, you know, in athletics, we now have people that kneel during the national anthem. And that's something that you talk about politics and you talk about the way things have gone in this country. That's something that I wanted to address in the novel.
I want to just interrupt for a second. That was something that touched me. Cunningham, which is one of the baseball players in your novel, was kneeling, and the hero of your book didn't like it, T.C. Hunter. And not to give too much away, but T.C. Hunter turns around and punches Cunningham for kneeling when T.C. Hunter got a single. Talk about the kneeling and how that affected the country and how it affected you personally watching football players. Not so much in baseball. I don't know if there was a lot of kneeling in baseball, but it was pretty prominent in football. And did the football players even know what they were kneeling about? You know, sometimes I thought they were even paid to kneel, and they, you know, did they realize that they were going against our country?
Yeah, I don't think they realize it. Yeah, I think anytime somebody brought that up, they'd be defensive about something like that. They would explain that it wasn't about the country. It wasn't about the soldiers that have died for our freedom. They go a different direction. But to us, it is. To a lot of us, it is. And that scene in the novel, that was an easy one to write because it had a lot of truisms to it. You know, there's a lot of anger there. From both sides. And I think there's misunderstanding there, and I'm not going to give my novel away either, but there's, you know, maybe towards the end, something else happens that changes that situation. But it's something that when the NFL started doing that, I stopped watching. I immediately stopped watching. I'll never go to an NFL game unless somebody, and I preempt that by saying, unless somebody apologizes and says, hey, you know, maybe we were wrong by allowing this. Other sports handle it differently, and you can certainly have protests and you can certainly be an activist, but the kneeling, you know, during a national anthem, that's something that draws attention to an individual and really does little to help the divisiveness that goes through our society. It doesn't help at all, really.
It really was very hurtful as a fan sitting home and watching it, and I really believe that the players didn't fully understand what they were doing. Maybe they were protesting the president and they thought they were protesting the president. I don't know if they even knew why they were protesting. And sometimes I feel that, you know, some of these agitators, if we bring politics into it, you know, when we see some of these, you know, these, you know, people burning down buildings and these crazy protests and, you know, spitting at the cops. Are these paid agitators, or are they really people that really feel this strongly? And why are they doing it?
To me, it's by design. It just seems like it's by design. I think a lot of them are paid. A lot of them are part of a, you know, I think there's a lot of things going on, Kerry, just trying to change our society. You know, that's never going to be something that sits well with me. That's another underlying theme of the novel is tradition. And, you know, there's this word out there, right? Progressivism, right? And they use this word intentionally, right? What's the root? Progress. They want to make themselves out to be progress by doing something that's different. And sometimes progress is, you know, goes backwards. You know, you have to understand history. You have to understand tradition. Progress isn't just doing something different. And I think that's what really people fall for. Not to get too deep, but I think in our country we've lost our faith, we've lost our religious base, and so people want something else to believe in, and that's where they go.
You know, it's really a shame when they say it's a peaceful protest and you see buildings, the protest burning down buildings behind, and, you know, and people are sitting there at home watching, and they're just like, what's happening to our country? And you know, sports does become an outlet, but still in the background, the building is still burning.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we've had heroes in the past and athletes in the past that have become heroes. I think we need that again.
You know, and you bring up the immortal, you know, the definite, who becomes immortal? Why does this one player become an immortal and the other player just stays as a great player? Why is that?
Well, my premise is that it has nothing to do with baseball. You can have prowess in sports, but it's what you do otherwise that makes you immortal. It turns you from a great to an immortal, somebody that'll always be remembered. And there's a lot of examples of that, and we can get into that at some point.
Yeah, in the novel you brought up John Wayne, and not just sports figures, Ronald Reagan, other types of figures that are non-sports. But as we're coming up to the break, this is Dr. Kerry Gelb for Open Your Eyes Radio on AM 1280 The Patriot. I'm speaking with author Ken Cavazzoni, that's Cavazzoni. Pick up his book, Immortal. We'll be back after the break.
MacuHealth, your science-born and tested solutions for visual performance, macular degeneration, and dry eye syndrome. New products coming soon. Embrace the science.
We're back with Ken Cavazzoni, author of Immortal, a great book. Pick it up. You could get it at where you could find all books. Amazon, wherever you buy your books, is a great place to buy this book. And I got to tell you, this book is going to touch your heart. And, you know, when I read your book and the hero in your book, T.C. Hunter, as I got toward the end of the book, I wanted more of T.C. Hunter. I wanted book number two, book number three, book number four. But you decided to kind of, not to give anything away, but you kind of brought it to a full story. Why did you do it that way rather than leaving it open for one, two, three, and four?
Well, I'm going to tell you, I'll give you a little secret, that there is a sequel out. Not out, but in the works, where I'm actually going through the perspective of T.C. Hunter's son. So I'm taking T.C. Hunter, and it's actually a really fun project for me, because I'm, in a way, I'm taking my journey with my own son through baseball and through travel baseball, and hopefully his success in the game. And I'm trying to take it from also not only the dad's perspective, but also from the kid's perspective. So, you know, when T.C. Hunter's son is 6 years old, he thinks T.C. Hunter is a hero. You know, by the time he's 13, he has a little bit of a different opinion of him. So that is actually going to be a sequel to that novel.
A typical American son's, I might add to that. And then they seem to come back to us. If somebody was going to play T.C. Hunter in a movie, who would you want it to be? And have you even thought about that?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, it's gonna have to be somebody that's extremely athletic. That's a good question. I'd have to give that one some thought.
Yeah, I mean, I've thought about it, and you know, I'm not a big movie person, so I don't watch a lot of movies, you know. So I really couldn't come up with anybody, but I did want to ask you about that. But let's get back to baseball for a second.
Sure.
Baseball is such a revered institution, you know, between the gloves, the balls, the fields. I remember growing up and playing on these horrible fields and, you know, and taking a ground ball in the chin and not bothering me, coming back for more. It was just the statistics. Baseball is such a game about statistics. And we compare the old timers with the new players. It's such a great game when you mix all those things together. What do you think about baseball statistics compared to other sports?
There is something about that, isn't there? Right. I mean, you really can't rattle off football statistics. Who's got the most touchdown passes and yards? You just don't rattle it off as easy. But with baseball, you can. It's commonplace, and you rattle it off pretty easily. It's a game that's so focused on statistics that I think that's the origin of being able to rattle off, you know, who's the leading home run hitter and who had the most hits. And it's a game of percentages. It's a game that, you know, you fail a lot more times than you succeed. So I think that's part of it too. You know, if you're going to be a free throw artist, you know, you're going to hit 95% of your free throws. Well, if you're going to be a baseball artist, you got to hit 3 out of every 10 times. So I think it's a game that is structured that way, and it leans towards, you know, those percentages. And the statistics are so much more relevant in the game too, because it's a way to compare eras. It's a way to you know, we went from a dead ball era in the 1920s to a live ball era in the 1930s as they tried to encourage home runs. Then you have modern day players that have a totally different approach, and guys are throwing harder, and there's analytics now. Don't get me started on that. But that's one theme in the novel as well, is about the new rules that have changed the fabric of the game itself. And I'm not a big fan of that, because when you're talking about statistics, you want it to be an even playing field, that's for sure.
You know, with the new rules, and you touch on it a little bit in the book, are there any of the new rules that you like? You know, I mean, I have to admit, I'm a purist, and I used to love a 4-hour game because baseball had no time, but it did get annoying. I remember the Dodgers had this relief pitcher. I can't remember his name, but God, it took him a minute to throw a ball, maybe 2 minutes before he would throw the ball. And it was really, it got kind of annoying. So do you think there's any of the rules that you do like, you know, the pitch clock or the bigger bases or only able to throw over 2 times, or is there any of it you like or you don't like any of them?
Well, I'll start off with what I hate. I hate the throw over rule. You can only throw over 2 times in the bigger bases. So how do you compare the base stealers of today to Ricky Henderson? You know, Ricky Henderson had to do it for real. And these guys, you know, a lot of these base stealers now, they can just wait for the 2 throws, and then they wait for the pitcher to hold the ball. And as the timer is about to go off, they know he's going to throw. So they get such great jumps. I was watching, for whatever reason, an Oakland A game the other day where their rookie broke the rookie's stolen base record, and the announcers made such a great thing of it. And to me, I was like, what's the big deal? The rules are tilted. So I don't like that at all.
Why do you think they made that rule? You can only throw over twice. I mean, of all the rules, that one seems to be the most ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. It's to speed up the game and to encourage base stealing. And I think that's a really, really big negative. I don't think you can impact the game that way. That to me is like a politician throwing a Band-Aid on something and not even understanding the consequences. You know, that drives me crazy. And as far as the pitch clock goes, I understand it. I understand the need for a speedier game. My resolution would be, okay, when there's nobody on base, go ahead with your pitch clock. But when there's somebody on base, no pitch clock. I mean, I look back, now you mentioned the Dodgers pitcher, but I look back at, you know, the famed Yankee game when Pedro Martinez, when they came back against Pedro Martinez, and I rewatched that game, and I was timing the time between pitches, and it was like 40 seconds. But the drama that was built up in those 40 seconds, you didn't notice. You loved it. Right. And now they're taking that away. And I at least hoped that it would eliminate the clock during the playoffs in the World Series, and they haven't. That drama is significant. I think it's a big part of the game.
Now, you also in your book, you talk about great players that have bad games and average players or below average players have great games. Now, these are all major league players. So a below average player, it's still a major league player and it's still a great athlete and a great player. And, you know, before we went on the air, I was looking up when I was a kid, Al Weiss hit a home run in the 69 World Series. He was on the Mets in game five, and he was a 219 career hitter, and he had this great World Series. You know, I think he would, you know, he was like 5 for 11, had 3 RBIs or something. And he was a big hero. They called him the Mighty Mite at that time. And that's what makes baseball so great, because you have this player, whether it's Luis Soho or Carlos Ruiz, all of a sudden they become a hero in the World Series. And you get these great players who lay an egg in the World Series, and then it kind of ruins their career. If you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'll give you another one. And my contemporary was Brian Doyle. Remember Brian Doyle? He had I forget which year it was. I don't know if it was 78 or had an outstanding series. I think he should have been the MVP.
Yep, 78. He filled in for Willie Randolph as Randolph got hurt.
Yeah, and he should have been the MVP. And I think they gave it to Bucky Dent, who had a good, really good series as well. But yeah, that's baseball. And what did they what did George Steinbrenner call Dave Winfield? Mr. May? You know, it's what you do in the playoffs that counts. And there is something to that, right? You're facing the best pitchers. You're facing intense circumstances. You know, your focus has to be up there, and certain players are going to hone in on that, and certain players aren't going to collapse under that. It's not easy.
I mean, even Barry Bonds, you know, early in his career, never did well in the World Series until later in his career.
And yeah, he was notorious for that.
Yeah. I mean, and then you get these guys that, you know, Tiger Woods, he could always perform on Sunday. He always did better under the pressure. Some people are just like that. It's an amazing thing.
I agree. And nowadays with baseball, there's so much concentration on analytics and how hard you hit a ball. And there is something called clutch. You know, the clutch players, you know, Thurman Munson was a guy to me, right? He was clutch. You know, so he had years that were great, other years that were subpar, but whenever they needed a hit, Thurman Munson came through. And Derek Jeter was like that. You know, the guys that come through, and it's a big part of the game. And there is something to it. It's not something to be glossed over. There is something to somebody that can take that moment and come through when the team needs it.
You know, there are players that they strike out and they think about it and it bothers them, you know, to their next at bat. And then there's other people that can handle disappointment. And those are the ones that seem to be able to make it. What is it that a major league player could do? Why are they different? How could they why are they able to handle disappointment and failure better than the average person?
Well, most of them are seasoned and they understand it. Especially the veterans, they know that in the end their statistics are going to look like the back of their baseball card. You know, so they don't take each game at heart as young players do, and that's a hard thing to learn. It really is. I think I was on the opposite side. I took things a little bit more to heart.
You know, I play softball now, and it bothers me when I make an out. So even at my age, I'm playing softball. I don't like making outs, and I start thinking about it. So, you know, and I think, you know, that's what really kind of could separate the major league players. I remember Mariano Rivera blowing his save, and they stick the microphone under his mouth, and they say to him, Mariano, how do you feel? And he goes, I already forgot about it. We got a new game tomorrow. I can't change the past. The only thing that matters is the future. I want to ask you, Ken, you know, When we look at baseball, baseball has changed a lot. We've brought in a lot of baseball players, international baseball players. You know, we've added teams, but it's made it harder to make the major leagues. And these international players, I got to say, how does the Dominican Republic have so many great players, that little place? I'm amazed by it.
I've got a friend who coached with me from the DR, and he sends me videos. Now, it's a little bit different there. the athletes there, the baseball players there, they pretty much forego schooling. I mean, they're on the baseball field, you know, 8 hours a day. He shows me things. He shows me 12-year-olds hitting balls, you know, 350 feet. It's crazy. And that's why, I mean, there's such a focus there. You know, and we have other sports that we tend to have some of our athletes veer towards. There, it's baseball. It's baseball, baseball, baseball. So I think it's made a tremendous improvement to the game. You know, I think it made the American player understand where they have to go. You know, these guys are no joke. You know, they've got goals and they want to take your job. So it's changed our mentality too, I think. You know, I've got a son playing college baseball now, and you know, if he wants to play pro, he's got to understand that there's that international base has made the game so much more competitive, has made the game so much better overall. I just think it's fabulous.
I mean, in my opinion, the two best players in baseball are not American, Otani and Ronald Acuna Jr. I mean, these are probably the two best players in baseball, and they're not American players.
Well, Otani's just ridiculous. It's going to be interesting what happens to him this offseason, given his injury. But you think of somebody like him, though, you know, he's not somebody that plays the field. So who would you rather have? I know he brings you an arm, too, but I don't know. Acuna, to me, is by far the best player around. He just gives you so much.
I agree with you. I mean, he is definitely the best player. And I had him on my fantasy team. So watching him every day scoring points was really amazing. I mean, me and my son had Acuna, and we came in first place, and the kid who had Otani came in last place. I don't know if that means anything, but yeah, it certainly was interesting. So I want to go back to what we talked about at the end of the last segment. How do you handle disappointment as a baseball player? Because baseball is a game of failure. How do you handle failure? How do you talk to yourself? I know in the book, you know, you mentioned like some of the players will have little sayings under their baseball cap, and they'll take off their cap and they'll read these sayings. But are there any tricks to being able to handle disappointment or failure? I should say failure.
Yeah, well, there's coping mechanisms, and if you watch hard enough, you'll see some players do it. You know, somebody that once in a while you'll see somebody grab a piece of grass and throw it off to the side. That's one of the coping mechanisms that's taught now. That, you know, whatever you just did, let's toss it away. Let's think about it for a second, and then toss it away and start over. And you got to have a short memory to play the game. I was a hothead. I wish I wasn't, and I was a hothead through my professional career, until I had one manager do something that nobody else did ever. Now, I would throw helmets, I would get angry at myself. And what's the instinct? Either yell at you, or coaches would either yell at you or leave you alone because they were kind of just afraid of you. I had one manager. His name was Frank Funk. When I was playing in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, he did something that nobody else did. I came in one of my tirades, he laughed at me. And then he made me realize what an idiot I was being. You know, so I wish I had that throughout my career, that I understood that, yeah, you know, take yourself seriously, but not so seriously, and take your at bat seriously, but not so seriously. And you got to have a short memory. The game doesn't warrant something that, you know, it'll snowball. Let's put it that way. If you don't have a short memory.
Before you talk about your son playing in sports, how much should a parent push their kid? And should a parent push their kid at all when it comes to sports?
I've seen the gamut, right? I've seen parents push kids. I've seen parents not push kids. I think it's got to come internally. I think you want to guide kids that have an inclination towards sports, but I don't think they should be pushed. There's so much out there now. So much. It's so different. You know, there's off-season training now that we never had, and it becomes a lot. And some kids are ready for it, and some kids, well, you could just tell, aren't and don't want it as bad as the parent does. And it, that always bothers me. I always, you know, my son's at a level now where, you know, it's pretty high up. I mean, he's on a Division I baseball team, and that's pretty cool. But I don't want it ever to be something that has anything to do with me. And I've always told them that in the past. It's, this is what you want to do. I'm here. I'll support you. But it's got to come from you. But you do see a lot of that.
And what kind of relationship did you have with your dad going through sports? Was it helpful? Was it hurtful? Did you have that ride home after a bad game where your dad would say to you all the things that you did that were wrong?
Yeah, my dad probably didn't do that, but he was there for me. My dad was a New York City fireman. And what was fun about that is, you know, he used to go in shifts, and he actually worked in the South Bronx of all places. So there were times that I'd have a game and he would say, "Oh, sorry, kid, but I'm not going to be able to make that one." And then I'd look up and there he was, and he'd find a way. Right? He'd find a way to change shifts with somebody, and he was at my games. That's something I'll always remember. So he never pushed me. We had a batting cage in my backyard, and it wasn't because of me. It was actually because of my brother who wanted it. And I kind of took it over at some point. So he was involved with me. He was a coach in my little league. He was my hitting instructor to a point. But then it did get to a point where, like everybody else, he kind of stepped aside and let me do my thing. One thing about my dad, which is really rough, is that he never got to see me play college. He passed away before he ever got to see me play a game. So talk about the national anthem and talk about being on a minor league field and hearing the national anthem before every game, every single game, I would think about that man. So he did something right.
Absolutely. Wow. And you mentioned that you had a batting cage in your backyard. How do you learn to hit 95 to 100?
Put the machine up. You got to see it. You got to experience it. The human brain is an amazing thing. Now, when I'll just give an example. When you go from college level, where you see a guy throwing 90 miles an hour once in a while, to single A, where everybody does, it really doesn't take long for your brain to adapt. So then you take it each level. There's going to be an adjustment period, but your brain does adapt to that. And your brain figures out the timing. It really does. Now, guys throwing 100 miles an hour, you know, there is a limit that I still get amazed at anybody who hits that. And they really don't hit it very well. But your brain definitely adapts. You kind of figure out things. You kind of figure out the rhythm of how, you know, your approach has to be when you're facing that kind of velocity. It's something that does happen naturally.
You know, I often think about tennis players. A slow tennis serve is 100 miles an hour, where a fast tennis serve is 120 to 140 miles an hour. Yeah. They could hit that. So the brain definitely could adapt. Of course, a racket is much bigger than a bat, but it just shows you can time it.
Yeah, you can. Absolutely. And after you see it for a bit, it becomes just like any other day because everybody does it. I remember people asking me, how do you hit that? After a while, it just becomes what you see, and it just becomes a natural thing.
And people at home are listening, they're wondering, what does it feel like to get hit with a 95 mile an hour fastball in the back or the leg to be hit by one of those pitchers?
Yeah, that's not fun. That's not fun at all.
You know,
that hurts quite a bit.
I mean, I have a 13-year-old that plays, and when they get hit by a 70 mile an hour pitch, those kids go down. So I just can't imagine what it's like to be hit by a 95 mile an hour pitch.
Yeah, it stings, that's for sure.
But those guys don't rub. It's amazing. So as we're coming up to the break, I do want to ask you, how does somebody like yourself who balance school and baseball at the same time, you know, you're going to Columbia, how do you balance that?
That was always something that was impressed on me by my parents early on. You know, if you're going to do something, do it right. So I was always a decent student. I was always a good student, and I always wanted to be a good baseball player. So I never thought about one having an issue with the other. I just never did.
I just want to thank Ken Cavazzoni for joining me today. He's such a great interview. He has such a great book. Ken, if they want to find out more about you, how could they do that?
Go to my website, kencavazzoni.com.
And next week, we're going to talk with Ken about a little bit more about his book. So stay tuned to next week to part two.
Your eyes and your vision are under attack. Damaging blue light from the sun, your phone, your computer, your tablet, even light bulbs and car headlights is constantly bombarding you. The good news is our eyes actually already have a line of defense to counter the effects of blue light. This defense is made up of three pigments called carotenoids. MacuHealth with Micromicell, the only supplement with the exclusive patent on all three macular carotenoids and Micromicell technology.
Fitting multifocal contact lenses presents a big opportunity to meet patient needs while growing your practice. Alcon is your partner not only with our innovative portfolio, but through e-learning. Learn to enhance your multifocal strategy today with the Alcon Experience Academy.
OIE Broadcasting is the emerging leader in social media. We use scientific entertainment to drive more patients into your office. Visit OIEBroadcasting.com and sign up today.